And the bad guys? The bad guys shoot at us. Best lesson my father ever taught me. I kissed the top of Sam's head and left him there. The door clicked shut behind me. I heard the night latch slide into the notch. Good boy. Ben was halfway down the hall. He motioned for me to join him. He pressed his lips fever hot against my ear. We clear the rooms, then we go down. We worked together. I took the point while Ben covered me. The Walker Hotel had an open door policy. Every lock had been busted at some point as survivors sought refuge during the waves. Also helpful was the fact that the Walker was perfect for the family on a budget. The rooms were roughly the size of Barbie's dream house. 30 seconds to check one. 4 minutes to clear them all. Back in the hall, Ben crushed his lips into my ear again. The shaft. He dropped to one knee in front of the elevator doors, gestured for me to cover the stairway door, then pulled out his 10-inch combat knife and shoved the blade into the crack. Ah, I thought, the old hide-in-the-elevator trick. So why was I covering the stairs? Ben pushed open the doors and waved me over. I saw rusty cables and a lot of dust, and smelled what I assumed to be dead rat. I hoped it was dead rat. He pointed at the darkness pooling below, and then I understood. We weren't checking the shaft. We were using it. I'm clearing the stairs, he breathed in my ear. You stay in the elevator, wait for my signal. He placed his foot against one door and leaned back against the other to hold them open. Patted the tiny space between his hip and the edge. Mouthed, let's go. Carefully, I eased over his legs, planted my butt in the space, and dropped my legs over the side. The top of the elevator looked 20 miles down. Ben smiled reassuringly. Don't worry, Sullivan, I won't let you fall. I inched forward until my butt dangled in open space. Nope, that won't work. I swung back to the edge, then maneuvered onto my knees. Ben grabbed my wrist and gave me a thumbs up with his free hand. I knee-walked down the shaft wall, gripping the edge until my arms were fully extended. Okay, Cassie, time to let go now. Ben's got you. Yeah, dumbass, and Ben's hurt and about as strong as a 3-year-old. When you let go, your weight is going to pull him off his perch and you'll both drop. He'll land on top of you and break your neck, and then he'll slowly bleed to death all over your paralyzed body. Oh, what the hell. I let go. I heard Ben grunt softly, but he didn't drop me and he didn't tumble down on top of me. Bending from the waist as he lowered me down until I saw his head silhouetted in the opening, his face masked in shadow. My toes brushed against the roof of the elevator. I gave him a thumbs up, though I wasn't sure if he could see it. 3 seconds. 4. And then he let go. I sank to my knees and felt around for the service hatch. Some grease, some dirt, and a lot of greasy dirt. Before electricity, they measured brightness and candle power. The light down here was about 1/2 of 1/2 of 1 candle. Then the doors above me closed and the candle power dropped to 0. Thanks, Parrish, you could have waited till I found the hatch. And when I did, the latch was stuck, probably rusted shut. I reached for my Luger with the thought of using the butt end as a hammer, then remembered I'd entrusted my semi-automatic pistol to a 5-year-old's care. I pulled the combat knife from my ankle holster and gave the latch 3 hard whacks with the handle. The metal screeched, a very loud screech. So much for stealth. But the latch gave. I pulled the hatch open, which resulted in another very loud screech, this time from the rusty hinge. Well, sure, this sounds really loud to you, kneeling right next to it. Outside the shaft, probably only a tiny, mouse-like squeaky squeak. Don't get paranoid. My father had a saying about paranoia. I never thought it was very funny, especially after hearing it 2,000 times. I'm only paranoid because everyone is against me. Only a joke, I used to think. Not an omen. I dropped into the utter dark of the elevator car. Wait for my signal. What signal? Ben neglected to cover that. I pressed my ear to the crack between the cold metal doors and held my breath. Counted to 10. Breathed. Counted to 10 again. Breathed. After 6-10 counts and 4 breaths and hearing nothing, I started getting a little antsy. What was happening out there? Where was Ben? Where was Dumbo? Our little band was being ripped apart one person at a time. A big mistake splitting up, but each time we didn't have a choice. We were being outplayed. Someone was making this look foolishly easy. Or multiple someones. After we went rogue in Dayton, Vosh dispatched 2 squads to hunt us down. That was it. That had to be it. One or possibly both squads had found our hiding place. We waited here too long. That's right, and why did you wait, Cassiopeia Defiance Sullivan? Oh yeah, because some dead guy promised he'd find you. So you closed your eyes and jumped off the cliff into that emptiness, and now you're shocked there's no big fat mattress at the bottom? Your fault. Whatever happens now, you're responsible. The elevator was not large, but in the pitch dark it seemed the size of a football stadium. I was standing in a vast underground pit. No light, no sound. A lifeless, lightless void frozen to the spot, paralyzed by fear and doubt. Knowing, without understanding how I knew, that Ben's signal wasn't coming. Understanding, without knowing how I understood, that Evan wasn't coming either. You never know when the truth will come home. You can't choose the time. The time chooses you. I'd had days to face the truth that now faced me in that cold, black space, and I'd refused. I wouldn't go there. So the truth decided to come to me. When he touched me on our last night together, there was no space between us. No spot where he ended and I began. And now there was no space between me and the darkness of the pit. He promised he would find me. Don't I always find you? And I believed him. After distrusting everything he said from the moment I met him, for the first time in the last words he spoke, I believed. I pressed my face against the cold metal doors. I had the sensation of falling, miles upon miles of empty air beneath me. I would never stop falling.
You're a mayfly, here for a day and then gone.
No, I'm still here, Evan. You're the one who's gone. You knew from the moment we left the farmhouse what would happen, I whispered into the void. You knew you were going to die, and you went anyway. I couldn't stay upright anymore. I had no choice. I slid down to my knees, falling. Falling. I would never stop falling. Let go, Cassie. Let go.
Let go? I'm falling. I'm falling, Evan.
But I knew what he meant. I'd never let him go. Not really. I told myself 1,000 times a day he couldn't have survived. Lectured myself that our holing up in this fleabag motel was useless, dangerous, crazy, suicidal. But I clung to his promise because letting go of the promise meant I was letting go of him. I hate you, Evan Walker, I whispered to the void. From inside the void, and from the void inside, silence. Can't go back, can't go forward, can't hold on, can't let go. Can't, 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 can't. What can you do? What can you do? I lifted my face. Okay, I can do that. I stood up. That too. I squared my shoulders and slipped my fingertips into the place where the 2 doors met. I'm stepping out now, I told the silent deep. I'm letting go. I forced the doors apart. Light flooded into the void, devouring the smallest shadow, down to the last one.
Chapter 14. I stepped into the lobby, our brave new world in microcosm. Shattered glass, mounds of trash piled into corners like autumn leaves blown there by the wind. Dead bugs on their backs, legs curled up. Bitter cold. So quiet, your breath was the only sound. After the hum vanished, the hush. No sign of Ben. Between the second floor and the stairs, something must have happened to him, and not a good something. I eased toward the stairway door, fighting the instinct to haul ass back to Sam before he disappeared like Ben, like Dumbo, like Pound Cake and Teacup, like 99.9% of everyone on Earth. Debris crackling beneath my boots. Cold air burning my face and hands. My hands gripping the rifle and my eyes barely blinking in the weak starlight that blared spotlight bright after the absolute dark of the elevator. Slow. Slow. No mistakes. Stairway door. I held the metal handle for a good 30 seconds, ear pressed against the wood, but all I heard was the thumping of my heart. Slowly, I pushed down the handle, pulled the door open to create a crack just wide enough to peek through. Totally dark. Totally soundless. Damn it, Parrish, where the hell are you? Nowhere to go but up. I slid into the stairwell. Snick. The door closed behind me. Plunged into darkness again. But this time I was determined to keep it on the outside where it belonged. The tart smell of death hung in the musty air. A rat, I told myself. Or a raccoon or some other woodland creature that got trapped in here. My boot came down on something squishy. Tiny bones crunched. I wiped off the gooey remains on the edge of a step. I didn't want to slip, tumble down to the bottom, break my neck, lie helplessly waiting for whoever it was to find me and put a bullet in my brain. That would be bad. I reached the tiny landing, one more flight, deep breath, almost there, and then the shot rang out, followed by another, then a third. Then a whole barrage as whoever was shooting emptied the magazine. I rocketed up the remaining steps, slammed through the door, and charged down the hall toward the room that was now missing a door, the room where my baby brother was, and my toe caught on something, a soft something I didn't see in my mad dash for Sam, and I went airborne, landing with a jaw-popping force on the thin carpeting, jumped up, glanced back, and saw Ben Parrish lying lifelessly there, arms outstretched. Dark wet blotch of blood seeping through that ridiculous yellow hoodie. And then Sam screamed, and, "I'm not too late, not too late, and here I come, you son of a bitch, here I come." And in the room a tall shadow loomed over the tiny figure whose tiny finger yanked impotently at the trigger of the empty gun. I fired. The shadow whirled toward me, then pitched forward, reaching for me. I slammed my foot down on its neck and jammed the muzzle of the rifle against the back of the shadow's head. "Excuse me," I gasped. I had no breath. "But you have the wrong room."
3. The Last Star. Chapter 15. As a child, he dreamed of owls. He hadn't thought of the dream in years. Now, as his life slipped away, the memory came back to him. The memory was not pleasant. The bird perched on the windowsill, staring into his room with bright yellow eyes. The eyes blinked slowly, rhythmically. Otherwise, the owl never moved. Watching the owl, watching him, paralyzed with fear, without understanding why. Unable to call for his mother, and, afterward, the sick feeling all over. Nauseated, dizzy, feverish. And the jittery, unnerving sensation of being watched that lingered for days. When he turned 13, the dream stopped. He had awakened. There was no need to hide the truth anymore. When the time came, his awakened self would need the gifts that the owl had given. He understood the dream's purpose, because his purpose had been revealed. Make ready. Prepare the way. The owl had been a lie to protect the tender psyche of his host body. After he awakened, another lie took its place. His life. His humanity was a lie, a mask, like the dream of owls in the dark. Now he was dying, and the lie was dying with him. There was no pain. He did not feel the bitter cold. His body seemed to float on a warm, boundless sea. The alarm signals from his nerves to the pain centers of his brain had been shut down. This gentle, painless easing of his human body into oblivion would be the final gift. And then, after the last human being was dead, rebirth. A new human body, unburdened by the memory of being human. He would not remember the past 18 years. Those memories and the emotions attached to them would be forever lost, and there was nothing that could be done about the agony attending that knowledge. Lost. Everything lost. The memory of her face. Lost. The time with her. Lost. The war declared between what he was and what he pretended to be. Lost. In the quiet of the winter-draped woods, floating on a boundless sea, he reached for her, and she slipped away. He knew what would come of it. He had always known. Once he found her imprisoned in snow and carried her back and made her whole, his death would be the price. Virtues are vices now, and death is the cost of love. Not the death of his body. His body was the lie. True death. The death of his humanity. The death of his soul. In the woods, in the bitter cold, on the surface of a boundless sea, whispering her name, and trusting her memory to the wind, to the embrace of the silent, sentinel trees, and to the care of the faithful stars, her namesake, pure and everlasting, the uncontained universe contained in her, Cassiopeia. Chapter 16. He woke to pain. Blinding pain in his head, his chest, his hands, his ankle. His skin was on fire. He felt as if he'd been dipped in boiling water. A bird perched on a tree branch above him, a crow, regarding him with regal indifference. The world belonged to the crows now, he thought. The rest were interlopers, short-timers. Smoke curled in the bare branches overhead, a campfire, and the smell of meat sizzling in a pan. He was propped up against a tree, covered by a heavy wool blanket with a rolled-up winter parka for a pillow. Slowly, he lifted his head an inch and realized immediately that any movement at all was a very bad idea. A tall woman came into view, carrying an armload of wood, then vanished from sight for a moment while she fed the fire. "Good morning." Her voice was low-pitched, lilting, and vaguely familiar. She sat beside him, pulled her knees to her chest, and wrapped her long arms around her legs. Her face was familiar, too. Fair-skinned, blonde, Nordic features, like a Viking princess. "I know you," he whispered. His throat burned. She pressed the mouth of her canteen against his raw lips, and he drank for a long time. "That's good," she said. "You were talking nonsense last night. I was worried you'd suffered something a little more serious than a concussion." She stood up and disappeared from view again. When she came back, she was holding a frying pan. She sat next to him, placing the pan on the ground between them. She was studying him with the same haughty indifference as the crow. "I'm not hungry," he said. "You have to eat." Not pleading, stating a fact. "Fresh rabbit. I made a stew." "How bad is it?" "Not bad. I'm a good cook." He shook his head and forced a smile. She knew what he meant. "It's pretty bad," she said. 16 broken bones, skull fracture, second-degree burns over most of your body. Not your hair, though. You still have your hair. That's the good news." The woman dipped a spoon into the stew, brought the spoon to her lips, blew gently, swiped her tongue slowly around the edge. "What's the bad news?" he asked. "Your ankle is fractured, fairly badly. That's going to take some time. The rest?" She shrugged, sipped the stew, pursed her lips. "Need salt." He watched her dig into her rucksack, searching for the salt. "Grace," he said softly. "Your name is Grace." "One of them," the woman said. Then she said her real name, the one she bore for 10,000 years. "I have to be honest, I like Grace better. So much easier to pronounce." She swirled the soup with the spoon, offered him a sip. His lips tightened. The thought of food. She shrugged and took another sip. "I thought it was debris from the explosion," she went on. "I never expected to find one of the escape pods, or you in it. What happened to the guidance system? Did you disarm it?" He thought carefully before he answered. "Malfunction." "Malfunction?" "Malfunction," he said louder. His throat was on fire. She held the canteen for him while he drank. "Not too much," she cautioned him. "You'll get sick." Water dribbled down his chin. She wiped it for him. "The base was compromised," he said. She seemed surprised.
"How?"
He shook his head, not sure. "Why were you there? That's the curious thing." "I followed someone in." This was not going well. For a person whose entire life had been a lie, lying did not come easily to him. He knew Grace would not hesitate to terminate his current body if she suspected that the compromise extended to him. They all understood the risk in donning the human mantle. Sharing a body with a human psyche carried with it the danger of adopting human vices, as well as human virtues. And far more dangerous than greed, or lust, or envy, or any of those things, or anything, was love.
"You followed someone? A human?"
"I didn't have a choice." That much was true, at least. "The base was compromised by a human." She shook her head with wonder. "And you abandoned your patrol to stop it." He closed his eyes. Perhaps you'd think he passed out. The smell of the stew made his stomach roll. "Very curious," Grace said. "There was always risk of a compromise, but from within the processing center. How could a human in your sector know anything about the cleansing?" Playing possum wasn't going to work. He opened his eyes. The crow had not moved. The bird stared at him, and he remembered the owl on the sill and the little boy in the bed and the fear. "I'm not sure she did."
"She?"
"Yes, it was a female.
Cassiopeia."
He looked sharply at her, couldn't help it. "How do you..." "I've heard it a lot over the past 3 days."
"3 days?"
His heart quickened. He had to ask. But how could he? Asking might make her more suspicious than she already was. It would be foolish to ask. So he said, "I think she might have escaped." Grace smiled. "Well, if she did, I'm sure we'll find her." He let his breath out slowly. Grace would have no reason to lie. If she had found Cassie, she would have killed her and had no reservations in telling him. Though Grace not finding her was no proof of life, Cassie still may not have survived. Grace reached into her rucksack again and took out a bottle of cream. "For the burns," she explained. Gingerly, she pulled the blanket down, exposing his naked body to the freezing air. Above them, the crow cocked its polished black head and watched. The cream was cold. Her hands were warm. Grace had brought him out of fire. He had brought Cassie out of ice. He'd carried her through the undulating sea of white to the old farmhouse, where he removed her clothes and plunged her freezing body into warm water. As Grace's hands, slick with salve, roamed his body, his fingers had worked through the ice encrusted in Cassie's thick hair, removing the bullet as she floated in the water stained pink by her blood. The bullet meant for her heart. His bullet. And, after he pulled her from the water and bandaged the wound, carrying her to his sister's bed, averting his eyes as he dressed her in his sister's gown, Cassie would have been mortified when she realized he'd seen her unclothed. Grace's eyes fixed on him. His eyes fixed on the teddy bear on the pillow. He pulled the covers to Cassie's chin. Grace pulled the blanket to his. "You're going to live," he told Cassie, more of a prayer than a promise.
"You're going to live," Grace told him.
"You have to live," he said to Cassie. "I have to," he said to Grace. The way she cocked her head as she looked at him, like the crow in the tree, the owl on the sill. "We all have to," Grace said, nodding slowly. "It's why we came." She leaned forward and kissed him gently on the cheek. Warm breath, cool lips, and the faint odor of wood smoke. Her lips slid from his cheek toward his mouth. He turned his head.
"How did you know her name?" she whispered in his ear.
"Cassiopeia. How did you know Cassiopeia?" "I found her camp, abandoned. She kept a journal."
"Ah.
And that's how you knew she planned to storm the base?"
"Yes."
"Well, it all makes perfect sense then. Did she say in her journal why she was storming the base?" her brother taken from a refugee camp to Wright-Patterson. She escaped. That's remarkable. Then she overcomes our defenses and destroys the entire command center. That's even more remarkable. It borders on the unbelievable. She picked up the pan, slung the contents into the brush, and rose to her feet. She towered over him, a 6-foot blonde colossus. Her cheeks were flushed, perhaps from the cold, perhaps from the kiss. "Rest," she said. "You're well enough to travel now. We're leaving tonight." "Where are we going?" Evan Walker asked. She smiled. "My place." Chapter 17. At sunset, Grace killed the fire, slipped the backpack and rifle over her shoulder, and scooped Evan from the ground for the 16-mile hike to her station house on the southern outskirts of Urbana. She would keep to the highway to make better time. There was little risk in it at this stage of the game. She hadn't seen a human being in weeks. Those she hadn't killed had been taken by the buses or had taken refuge against the onslaught of winter. This was the in-between time. In another year, perhaps two, though no more than 5, there would be no need for stealth, because there would be no more prey to stalk. The temperature plunged with the sun. Ragged clouds raced across the indigo sky, driven by a north wind that toyed with her bangs and playfully flipped the collar of her jacket. The first stars appeared, the moon rose, and the road shone ahead, a silver ribbon twisting across the black backdrop of dead fields and empty lots, and the gutted shells of houses long abandoned. She stopped once to rest and drink and spread more salve over Evan's burns. "There's something different about you," she mused. "I can't put my finger on it," putting her fingers all over him. "I didn't have an easy awakening," he said. "You know that." She grunted softly. "You're a brooder, Evan, and a very sore loser." She wrapped him back up in the blanket, ran her long fingers through his hair, looked deeply into his eyes. "There's something you're not telling me." He said nothing. "I felt it," she said. "The first night when I hauled you out of the wreckage, there's a," she searched for the right words, "a hidden room that wasn't there before." His voice sounded hollow to him, empty as the wind. "Nothing is hidden." Grace laughed. "You should never have been integrated, Evan Walker. You feel far too much for them to be one of them." She picked him up as easily as a mother her newborn child. She lifted her face to the night sky and gasped. "I see her. Cassiopeia, the queen of the night." She pressed her cheek against the top of his head. "Our hunt is over, Evan." Chapter 18. Grace's station was an old, one-story wooden frame house on Highway 68, located at the exact center of her assigned 6-square-mile patrol sector. Aside from boarding up the broken windows and repairing the exterior doors, she'd left the house as she found it. Family portraits on the walls, heirlooms, and mementos too large to carry easily, smashed furniture, and open drawers, and the 1,000 pieces of the occupants' lives deemed worthless by looters were scattered in every room. Grace did not bother to clean up the mess. When spring arrived and the 5th wave rolled out, she would be gone. She carried Evan to the 2nd bedroom at the rear of the house, the kids' room, with bright blue wallpaper and toys littering the floor, and a mobile of the solar system hanging dejectedly from the ceiling. She laid him in one of the twin beds. A child had scratched his initials into the headboard. K.M. Kevin? Kyle? The tiny room smelled like the plague. There wasn't much light. Grace had boarded the window in here, too. But his eyesight was much more acute than an ordinary human's, and Evan could see the dark splotches of blood that had been flung on the blue walls during someone's death throes. She left the room, returning after a few minutes with more salve and a roll of bandages. She worked quickly, wrapping the burns as if she had pressing business elsewhere. Neither spoke until she had covered him again. "What do you need?" Grace asked. "Something to eat? Bathroom?" "Clothes." She shook her head. Not a good idea. A week on the burns, 2, maybe 3 on the ankle. I don't have 3 weeks. 3 days is too long. For the first time, he thought it might be necessary to neutralize Grace. She touched his cheek. Call if you need anything. Stay off that ankle. I'd have to get some supplies. I wasn't expecting company. How long will you be gone? No more than a couple hours. Try to sleep. I'll need a weapon. Evan, there isn't anyone within 100 miles, she smiled. Oh, you're worried about the saboteur. He nodded. I am. She pressed her pistol into his hand. Don't shoot me. He wrapped his fingers around the grip. I won't. I'll knock first. He nodded again. That would be a good idea. She paused by the door. We lost the drones when the base fell. I know. Which means we're both off the grid. If something should happen to one of us, or any of us. Does it matter now? It's almost over. Grace nodded thoughtfully. Do you think we'll miss them? The humans? He wondered if she was making a joke. He'd never heard her try before. Joking wasn't in her character. Not the ones out there. She gestured beyond the walls at the wider world. The ones in here. Hand to her chest. You can't miss what you don't remember, he said. Oh, I think I'll keep her memories, Grace said. She was a happy little girl. Then there'll be nothing to miss, will there? She folded her arms over her chest. She was leaving and now she wasn't. Why didn't she leave? I won't keep all of them, she said, meaning the memories. Only the good ones. That's been my worry from the beginning, Grace. The longer we play at being human, the more human we become. She looked at him quizzically and said nothing for a very long, very uncomfortable moment. Who's playing at being human? She asked. Chapter 19. He waited until her footfalls faded. Wind whistled in the cracks between the plywood and the window frame. Otherwise, he heard nothing. Like his eyesight, his hearing was exquisitely acute. If Grace was sitting on the porch combing her hair, he would hear it. First, the gun. He pulled the magazine from the frame. Just as he suspected, no bullets. He thought the gun had been too light. Evan allowed himself a quiet laugh. The irony was too much. Their primary mission had not been to kill, but to sow mistrust among the survivors and drive them like frightened sheep to slaughterhouses like Wright-Patterson. What happens when the sowers of mistrust become its reapers? Reapers. He fought back a hysterical giggle. He took a deep breath. This was going to hurt. He sat up. The room spun. He closed his eyes. No, that made it worse. He opened his eyes and willed himself to remain upright. His body had been augmented in preparation for his awakening. That was the truth the dream of the owl disguised, the secret that the screen memory kept him from seeing, and therefore from remembering. While he and Grace and tens of thousands of children like them had slept, gifts had been delivered in the night. Gifts they would need in the years to come. Gifts that would turn their bodies into finely tuned weapons. For the designers of the invasion had understood a simple, though counterintuitive, truth. Where the body went, the mind followed. Give someone the power of the gods, and he will become as indifferent as the gods. The pain subsided. The dizziness eased. He slid his legs off the edge of the bed. He needed to test the ankle. The ankle was the key. The other injuries were serious but inconsequential. He could manage those. Gently, he applied pressure to the ball of his foot, and a lightning bolt of agony rocketed up his leg. He fell onto his back, gasping. Overhead, dusty planets were frozen in orbit around a dented sun. He sat up and waited for his head to clear. He wasn't going to find a way around the pain. He would have to find a way through it. He eased himself onto the floor, using the side of the bed to support his weight. Then he forced himself to rest. No need to rush. If Grace returned, he could explain that he fell out of bed. Slowly, By inches, he scooted his butt along the carpet until he was flat on his back, seeing the solar system behind a shower of white-hot meteors that cascaded across his field of vision. The room was freezing, but he was sweating profusely. Out of breath, heart racing, skin on fire. He focused on the mobile, the faded blue of the Earth, the dusky red of Mars. The pain came in waves. He floated now in a different kind of sea. The slats beneath the bed were nailed into place and weighed down by the heavy frame and mattress. No matter. He wiggled into the tight space beneath, the bodies of decayed insects crunching under his weight, and there was a toy car on its back, and the twisted limbs of a plastic action figure from the time when heroes populated children's daydreams. He broke the board free with three hard whacks of the heel of his hand, scooched back the way he came, and broke the other end free. Dust settled into his mouth. He coughed, sending another tsunami of pain across his chest, down his side, to curl anaconda-like around his stomach. 10 minutes later, he was contemplating the solar system again, worried that Grace would find him passed down, clutching a 4x6 bed slat to his chest. That might be a little more difficult to explain. The world spun. The planets held still. There's a hidden room. He had crossed the threshold into that room, where a simple promise threw 1,000 bolts. I'll find you. That promise, like all promises, created its own morality. To keep it, he would have to cross a sea of blood. The world unloosed, the planets bound. Chapter 20. Night had fallen by the time Grace returned, her arrival presaged by the glow of a lamp expanding in the hall outside. She set the lamp on the bedside table, and the light threw shadows that engulfed her face. He did not protest when she drew down the covers, unwrapped the bandages covering his wounds, and exposed his body to the frigid air. "Did you miss me, Evan?" she murmured, fingertips slick with salve sliding over his skin. "I don't mean today." "How old were we then?" 15? 16, he answered. You asked me if I was afraid of the future. Do you remember?"
"Yes."
"Such a human question." The fingers of one hand massaging him, while the fingers of the other slowly unbuttoned her shirt.
"Not as much as the other one I asked."
She tilted her head inquisitively. Her hair fell over her shoulder. Her face lost in shadow, and her shirt falling open like a curtain drawn back.
"What was that?" she whispered.
"If you'd not been for a very long time, inexpressibly lonely?" The coolness of her fingers, the heat of his seared flesh. "Your heart is beating very fast," she breathed. She stood up. He closed his eyes.
"For the promise."
Just outside the circle of light, Grace stepped out of the pants that pooled around her ankles. He did not watch. "Not so lonely," Grace said, her breath caressing his ear. "Being locked in these bodies does have its compensations."
"For the promise."
And Cassie, the island he swam toward, rising from a blood-filled sea. "Not so lonely, Evan," Grace said. She touched his lips with her fingers, his neck with her lips. He had no choice. His promise afforded none. Grace would never let him go. She would not hesitate to kill him if he tried. There could be no outrunning her or hiding from her. No choice. He opened his eyes, reached up with his right hand, and ran his fingers through her hair. His left hand slid beneath the pillow. Above them, he could see the lonely sun stripped of its offspring, shining in the lamplight. He thought Grace might notice the planets were missing. He expected her to ask why he needed to remove them, though it wasn't the planets he needed. It was the wire. But Grace hadn't noticed. Her mind had been on other things.
"Touch me, Evan," she whispered.
He rolled hard to his right and smashed his left forearm into her jaw. She stumbled backward as he came off the bed, driving his shoulder into her midsection. She sank her nails deep into the burns on his back and ripped. The room went black for a moment, but he didn't need to see. He just needed to be close. She may have seen the makeshift garrote of broken wood and mobile wire in his hand. Or she might have been just lucky, but her fist closed around the wire and pushed as he drew it tight. He swept her leg with the outside of his good ankle and took her to the floor, following her body down, crushing his knee into her lower back on impact. No choice. He summoned every ounce of augmented strength that remained into tightening the wire, until it sliced through her palm and hit bone. She bucked against his weight. He swung his right knee around and ground it into her head. Tighter, tighter. He smelled blood. His, hers. The room spun around, sinking deep into blood. His, hers. Evan Walker held still. Chapter 21. When it was done, he crawled to the bed and pulled out the broken slat. Little long for a crutch. He had to hold the board at a difficult angle, but it would have to do. He hobbled to the other bedroom, where he found men's clothing. A pair of jeans, a plaid shirt, a hand-knit sweater, and a leather jacket with the name of the owner's bowling team, the Urbana Pinheads, emblazoned on the back. The fabric scraped and rubbed against his raw skin, making every movement a study in pain. Then he shuffled into the living room, where he found Grace's rucksack and rifle. He threw both over his shoulder. Hours later, resting in the nest-like mangle of metal in the middle of an 8-car pileup on Highway 68, he opened the sack to take inventory and found dozens of plastic baggies labeled with black marker, each bag containing clippings of human hair. At first he was puzzled. Whose hair was this, and why was it in baggies, each neatly marked with dates? Then he understood. Grace was taking trophies from her kills. Where the body went, the mind followed. He fashioned a splint for his ankle from two pieces of broken metal and the rest of the bandage roll. He drank a few sips of water. His body ached for sleep, but he would not sleep again until he kept his promise. He lifted his face to the pinpricks of pure light fixed above him in the limitless dark. "Don't I always find you?" The headlamp of the car beside him exploded in a shower of pulverized glass and plastic. He dove beneath the nearest vehicle, dragging the rifle behind him. Grace. It had to be. Grace was alive. He left too quickly. He assumed too much, hoped too much. And now he was trapped, pinned down with no way out. And Evan realized in that moment how promises can be kept in the most unexpected of ways. He'd found Cassie by becoming her. Wounded, trapped beneath the car, unable to run, unable to rise, at the mercy of a faceless, merciless hunter, a silencer engineered to snuff out the human noise. Chapter 22. He met, found would be more accurate, Grace the summer they both turned 16 at the Hamilton County Fair. Evan was standing outside the exotic petting zoo tent with his little sister, Val, who had been demanding to see the white tiger since they arrived early that morning. It was August. The line was long. Val was tired and grouchy and sticky with sweat. He'd put her off. He didn't like to see animals in captivity. When he looked into their eyes, something in their eyes looked back at him. He found Grace first, standing beside the funnel cake trailer, a dripping wedge of watermelon in her hand, blonde hair that fell to the middle of her back, cool, nearly arctic features, especially the ice blue eyes, and the cynical turn of her mouth, glistening with juice. She turned toward him, and he quickly looked away, to the face of his baby sister, who would be dead in less than 2 years, a fact he carried within him, locked away in a different kind of hidden room. Sometimes it was hard to shake. The knowledge that every face he saw was the face of a corpse to be. His world was peopled with living ghosts. "What?" Val asked. He shook his head. "Nothing." He took a deep breath and glanced toward the trailer again. The tall blonde girl was gone. Inside the tent, behind a steel mesh fence, The white tiger panted in the heat. Small children crowded in front. Behind them, cameras and smartphones clicked. The tiger remained regally indifferent to the attention.
Beautiful,
a husky voice murmured in Evan's ear. He did not turn. He knew, without looking, it was the girl with the long blonde hair and lips that glistened with watermelon juice. The exhibit was packed. Her bare arm brushed against his. And sad, Evan said. No, Grace said. He could tear through that fence in 2 seconds, rip off a kid's face in 3.
He's choosing to be there. That's the beautiful thing.
He looked at her. Her eyes were even more startling up close. They bored into his, and in a knee-weakening instant, he knew the entity hiding inside Grace's body.
We should talk, Grace whispered.
Chapter 23. At dusk, the lights of the Ferris wheel were switched on, and the tinny music was turned up, and the crowd swelled along the midway, cut-off shorts and flip-flops, and the smell of coconut-scented sunscreen, and the waddle of big-bellied men in John Deere caps with deeply calloused hands, and wallets attached to belt loops bulging in back pockets. He handed Val off to their mother, then headed for the Ferris wheel to wait nervously for Grace. She materialized out of the crowd, holding a large stuffed animal, a white Bengal tiger, plastic bright blue eyes, only slightly darker than hers. I'm Evan, he said. I'm Grace. They watched the giant wheel turn against the purple sky. Do you think we'll miss it when it's gone? He asked. I won't, her nose crinkled. The smell of them is horrible. I can't get used to it. You're the first I've met since... She nodded. Me too. Do you think it's an accident? No. I wasn't coming today, but this morning when I woke up, there was this little voice. Go. Did you hear it? He nodded. Yes. Oh, good. She sounded relieved. For 3 years I've been wondering if I'm crazy. You're not. You don't wonder? Not anymore. She smiled archly. Do you want to go for a walk? They wandered over to the deserted showgrounds and sat on the bleachers. The first stars appeared. The night was warm, the air moist. Grace wore a pair of shorts and a sleeveless white blouse with a lace collar. Sitting close to her, Evan could smell licorice. This is it, he said, nodding at the empty corral with its mangled floor of sawdust and manure. What? The future. She laughed as if he'd made a joke. The world ends, and the world begins again. It's always been that way. You're never afraid of what's coming? Never? Never. Hugging the stuffed tiger in her lap, her eyes seemed to take on the color of whatever she looked at. Now she was looking up at the darkening sky, and her eyes were a bottomless black. They spoke for a few minutes in their native language, but it was difficult and they gave up quickly. Too many words were unpronounceable. He noticed that she was much calmer afterward, and he realized it wasn't the future that frightened her. It was the past. The fact that she feared the entity inside her body was a figment of a young human girl's shattered mind. Meeting Evan validated her existence. You're not alone, he told her. He looked down and discovered her hand in his. One hand for him, the other for the tiger. That's been the worst part, she agreed. Feeling as if you're the only person in the universe. That the whole thing is here, touching her chest. And nowhere else. Years later, he would read something quite similar in the diary of another 16-year-old girl. The one he found and lost, found, then lost again. Sometimes I think I might be the last human on Earth. Chapter 24. The car's undercarriage against his back, the cold asphalt against his cheek, the useless rifle clutched in his hand. He was trapped. Grace had several options. He had 2. No, if there was any hope of keeping his promise, he had just 1. Cassie's choice. She had made a promise too, A hopeless, suicidal promise to the one person on earth who still mattered to her. Mattered to her more than her own life. She stood up that day to face the faceless hunter because her death was nothing compared to the death of that promise. If there was any hope left, it lay in love's hopeless promises. He crawled forward, past the front bumper, into the open air. And then, like Cassie Sullivan, Evan Walker stood up. He tensed, waiting for the finishing round. When Cassie stood up that cloudless autumn afternoon, her silencer had run. He did not think Grace would run. Grace would finish what she began. But no finish came. No silencing bullet, connecting Grace to him as if by a silver cord. He knew she was there. Knew she could see him standing crookedly in front of the car. And he realized there was no escaping the past. No dodging inevitable consequences. Cassie's terror, her uncertainty and pain. They belonged to him now. Overhead, the stars. Straight ahead, the road that shone in the stars' light. The tight grip of the freezing air and the medicinal smell of the ointment Grace had spread over his burns. Your heart is beating very fast. She's not going to kill you, he told himself. Not the goal. If killing you was the goal, she wouldn't have missed that shot. There could be only one answer. Grace intended to follow him. He was a riddle to her, and following him was the only way to solve the riddle. He had escaped the trap only to sink deeper into the pit. Keeping his promise now was not being faithful. It was an act of betrayal. He couldn't outrun her, not with the bad ankle. He couldn't reason with her. He could barely articulate his own reasons anymore. He could wait her out, stay here, do nothing, and risk Cassie being discovered by soldiers of the fifth wave, or abandoning the hotel before his stalemate with Grace ended. He could force a confrontation, but he'd failed once, and the odds were he would again. He was too weak, too hurt. He needed time to heal, and there was no time. He leaned against the hood of the car and looked up at the star-encrusted sky, undimmed by human lights. Scrubbed clean of contaminants. And these, the same stars that shone on the world before humankind walked upon it. For billions of years, these same stars. And what was time to them? Mayfly, Evan whispered. Mayfly. He shouldered the rifle and wormed his way through the pile-up back to the backpack of supplies, which he threw over the other shoulder. Tucked the makeshift crutch beneath his arm. The going would be slow. Painfully slow, but he would force Grace to choose between letting him go and following him. Deserting her assigned territory at the moment when desertion could mean a serious setback in the carefully constructed timetable. He would swing north of the hotel, north toward the nearest base. North where the enemy had fled and retrenched and waited for spring to launch the final, finishing assault. That's where hope lay. Where all hope had been from the beginning. On the shoulders of the brainwashed child soldiers of the fifth wave. Chapter 25. Later that evening, on the day they met, Evan and Grace walked along the midway beneath the lights that beat back the dark, weaving their way through the crowd, past the ring toss and balloon dart game and basketball free throw. Music blared from speakers mounted on the light poles, and bubbling beneath the music, was the sound of a thousand conversations, like an undercurrent. And the flow of the crowd was like a river too, eddying and swirling, swift here, languid there, tall and lissome and striking in their good looks. Evan and Grace drew attention from the passers-by, which made him uncomfortable. He never liked crowds, preferring the solitude of the woods and the fields of the family farm. An inclination that would serve him well when the time of cleansing arrived. Time. Above them, the stars turned like the points of light on the Ferris wheel that loomed above the fairgrounds, though too slowly for the human eye to register. The hands of the universal clock that was winding down, that had been winding down from the beginning, and the faces that passed marking the time, like the stars themselves, prisoners to it. Evan and Grace were not. They had conquered the unconquerable, denied the undeniable. The last star would die. the universe itself would pass away, but they would go on and on.